Hello, Internet, and welcome to episode 20 of the Going Deeper podcast. My name is Robbie, and joining me to my right is JD.
Hello.
And Jeff.
Good morning.
Well, how's it going, guys?
Very good. Very good.
My voice has been better.
He's got that Darth Vader thing going on.
Got that going on.
So. Yes, he's been quoting Star Wars.
Yes. My brother accused me of sounding like Darth Vader last night, so it'll be, I'm sorry out there to you and internet world. My apologies.
Well, I can't believe that we are on episode 20 already. I mean, I think this year
that's just amazing.
Gone quickly.
Yeah, flying by. And so, but, you know, as always, I'm usually scouring the internet for great news stories, and I found one for you guys.
Yay.
The heading of this reads, Florida City warns residents of zombies and power outage. So apparently they had a power outage that 7,000 customers lost power in the city of Lake Worth, Florida. And but somebody also said, it says, here's what the message they got. Power outage and zombie alert for residents of Lake Worth.
Zombie alert.
Somebody messed up. I didn't realize that was a warning that we actually had, you know, like that's, but the city spokesman, Ben Kerr, later posted on Facebook message saying officials were investigating the bogus alert and that he wanted to, quote unquote, reiterate that Lake Worth was not having any zombie activity currently.
So this guy felt compelled to say that.
Yeah, well,
that's disturbing.
Well, it's probably more that the city, I think people are like waiting for a zombie apocalypse sometimes. And so to calm the residents.
Calm fears.
Yeah, yeah. So
see, my bigger concern is, do they actually have that as a standard warning that can be sent out?
That would be concerning.
That's really the question. Yeah. Is that a standard warning? There's a button that you can push that sends out a zombie alert.
It feels a little like the Hawaii missile attack.
That's right. That's
but
the
this
one
would
I'm
have been
thinking
like,
about.
It's like missile attack, test missile attack, zombie attack,
zombie alert,
test zombie attack. Yeah. You know,
like, is that in the list of potential standard warnings that you could send out to be like the tornado warning that we all got the other night? Like, is that an option?
I kind of hope it is.
That's what I want to know.
Was it just because the power outage occurred when the TV show's on about zombies or something?
I don't know. Somebody in charge. Somebody's losing their job over this. That's all I know.
Yeah, there's a head that's going to roll.
Yes. That's all we can, that's all we can be certain
of. I mean, you've got some, like, crackpot that, like, added it. And I mean, I think that's probably the most likely, you know, scenario.
I just hope he
right?
made 20 like, bucks from his friends because he's going
like,
to need that.
Hey,
do
you dare me to like add zombies to this whole power outage thing? Okay.
Yes. Yes. The world that we live in.
Yeah.
It's the war of the worlds moment, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and I think that's exactly it. I mean, this is, you got people in the street, you know, just madness, cats and dogs living together. It's, you know, insanity. Ghostbusters. No one. Okay.
Never actually seen that one.
What? Oh, just stop the recording right now. Nope. This is. We'll be back after he watches this.
No. I think I've been on like around people who had it on, but I never actually just sat down to truly take that in.
It's a classic. Yeah, Ghostbusters. I think it was what 1984 or something like that. Yeah,
the original one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the original.
Wow.
So fantastic. And now we're just reminiscing and I'm showing
one.
My what?
You weren't even around, were you?
Oh yeah, I was born.
You were born.
In 84.
I was gonna say I was one.
Gosh.
I was like in utero in the theater, I guess, you know, I'm
there
sure.
You go.
But well, hey, we are in the middle of a series about serving. Go serve. And this week, Jeff, you delivered a message of why we serve, about the Great Commission, about Jesus really commanding us to go and serve, that this is not an optional task to do. And you had mentioned that during this podcast, you want to talk about how we partnered with our mission in Haiti, the La Croix mission, make sure I say it right, and how we partner with them and how that came to be. And so maybe you can just talk a little bit about that with us, and we can just talk about kind of your experiences in Haiti and then how people can get involved if they want to hear more and learn more.
Okay. You know, when we made the decision in 2007 that we needed to begin thinking of an international mission. We had some very definite criteria that we brought into that process. And many of us on the leadership team had been in previous church experiences where they supported a large number of missionaries, but at very small levels. So they might be sending $25 a month to a missionary in Southeast Asia or something like that. And they would have this long list of missions they supported, but in reality, the actual amount of support was quite small. And we really didn't feel like that fit who we were. And so what we decided is we wanted to try and identify one mission that we felt like we could really partner with, a mission that we could actually put people on the field, a mission that we could become very much involved in, and a mission where we would almost consider the people who were in leadership there at the mission as part of us and part of our, almost like part of our staff kind of thing. And that's kind of the relationship that we wanted. And so throughout 2008, we looked at a variety of different missions, and we had these criteria that we wanted to bring into this discussion. And the first was we wanted the mission to be cross-cultural. That was the first thing. And part of the reason for that is we live in Highland County, which is predominantly white, white middle class. In fact, it's so predominant that white middle class is about 97% of the population. The total black, Hispanic, and Oriental population in Highland County is less than 3%. And so we live in a predominantly white area. And we felt like it was important to stretch ourselves and to deliberately partner with a group of people who were ethnically different from us. That was the first thing. The second thing that we felt like was really important was what we called indigenous leadership. In other words, we wanted to serve under people who actually were from the area we were going to be going into. We felt like that was very important because those people know what their needs are. It's not like we're coming in and saying, oh, this is what we want to do for you. No, we come in starting with a question. What can we do for you? How can we best serve you? And we allow them to set the tone, set the direction for how we serve them. And we felt like that was crucial. A third thing that we wanted is we wanted it to be Western Hemisphere. We really felt like for us to be actively involved in the ministry and to be able to get as many of our people on the ground working in that mission as possible, it had to be in the Western Hemisphere. Otherwise, the cost would simply be so outrageous, it would be prohibitive for most people. And so we focused on North and South America. And then finally, we wanted a ministry that we believed, as best we could tell, had a similar ministry philosophy to us. We've always kind of had the idea of when it comes to helping people who are in need, it's important not just to give them a hand out, but to give them a hand up, to try and work with people so that they have an opportunity to better themselves rather than just us throwing money at a problem or something like that. And so as we began to look around, we found the LaCroix New Testament Mission. Now, fortunately, at the time, we had a couple of people who were very actively involved here at Good News Gathering. In fact, one of them was on staff who'd had prior experience with Pastor Pierre and the LaCroix Mission.
And Pastor Pierre is the leader of that.
He's the leader, okay. Yes. And he began that mission back in the early 80s. And that was one thing that really appealed to us is this ministry not only had a long history that we could look at, but it had a long history of success. We saw it grow from initially one school and one little church. I think the school originally had maybe 30 students in it, met in a thatch roof kind of hut. And Pastor Pierre, over the years, had grown this thing into where it is now, which is seven different missions in seven different villages. There are seven schools, seven churches, two medical clinics. They serve approximately 3,500 children. It's just amazing the leadership that he has brought to this. And
yeah, that's quite the infrastructure for that area of the world.
Oh my.
To maintain it's amazing. That upkeep and yeah.
And the interesting, one of the interesting things is that he was not originally from that area of Haiti. He was actually born in northern Haiti in an area known as Cape Haitien. And what happened was he was going through seminary and he went, I believe, a Nazarene seminary in Port-au-Prince. He was traveling through that area, and God, he said he basically heard the voice of God saying, "This is where I want you to, this is where I want you to land, and I want you to start something here." And I remember him telling the stories. He was like, "But God, these people are so poor, and I don't have any money. How's this going to work?" And basically, what he felt God saying to him was, "Don't worry about the money. You do the work, and I'll provide." Mm. And away he went. And it's just been an amazing success story. And they have, you know, they've developed these schools. They now have, I think it is four kids that are in university that they are helping, like with kind of scholarship type money to help these kids go to the university, because otherwise they couldn't afford it. And they're also, as Pastor Evans talked about this past weekend, they're also in the process of creating a trade school. And so these are just awesome developments. But it's just been a tremendous experience for us.
Yeah.
But those were the four big criteria.
So you issued to a former staff member those kind of four criteria that we needed. Mm-hmm. And so that person had some former experience with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so then kind of presented, hey, we could partner. And so mm-hmm. what year was that? Do you remember?
That would have been 2008.
So 2008. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So we're at and, 10 years then mm-hmm. of involvement with them, which is great.
Yeah, we did look at some others, but when we started looking at the track record and we started looking at how he ran the organization, that really appealed to us. And then in January of 2009, we sent our first team down there, and really it was as much exploratory as anything, because three of the members of the original team, and I think there were eight maybe. It was a relatively small team. We actually went with another church from Ohio because we didn't know that much about it. For us, it was a matter of just kind of getting ourselves there and then, okay, now what do we do? But we were really there to explore the mission and make sure that we really felt like it was the right fit.
Yeah.
And so three of those members were leadership team members, and they were eyeballing everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah, because one of the you know, downsides. Well, it's good. Hey, we can support a lot of ministries, like you were saying, and mm-hmm. do that. But one of the downsides to that I've seen is there's really not a lot of accountability.
Exactly.
And so we've never met the people we're sending money to. We don't know what they're doing, you know. And not that we're trying to control what you're doing with that money, but right. we want to know that I think it's being good steward to know that there is fruit being born from our investment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to sow in a different field if we're not harvesting anything, you know?
Sure.
And so, yeah, so it makes sense to go and look at it and investigate and eyeball everything. So how did that, were you on that trip then?
Yes, I was.
So how did that trip go? Do you remember?
Actually, I think, as I recall, the three leadership team members were myself, Steve Patton, and Karen Kenner. And Karen was a former nurse. And so she was kind of watching the medical clinic very closely to see how it was operating. Steve was kind of the operational guy. He was watching everything. And I'll never forget it because I bet we weren't on the ground more than an hour at the mission itself. And he came up to me and said, "There is no wasted money here. I'm looking at the way this thing operates, and they are stretching every dime they get." And that made us feel really good. I worked in the school, and you know, you watch how those students come in there. They're all in these uniforms. It's beyond me how they manage to keep those things clean. But they, the kids are, it's just an amazing sight to see. And I always work in the high school with the oldest students, because they're required to take philosophy in what they call 13th grade, which at this time they don't actually have that grade there on site. They have to go someplace else to get that final grade before they go into the university if they qualify. They have a testing process, and if you don't do well on these tests, then you don't go. You have to find something else to do. And so it's quite a bit different than the United States, the way their educational system works.
Yeah, interesting on that. Mm-hmm. So you guys go on this trip, and then, you know, I guess what was kind of the, you said, hey, this is the deciding factor. We know that this is exactly where we're supposed to go. Was there, mm-hmm. was there an aha moment, or is just kind of all coming together and seeing that?
Well, I would imagine it was probably different aha moments for different members of the team. For me, it was hearing Pastor Pierre talk, and of course he kind of gave us a guided tour of the whole mission and just how it operated, and the fact that they were being contacted by other villages and had been at different times to create a school in those villages. And his approach fit us perfectly, because he said, you know, I'll go in and I'll talk with these people, and then the question becomes, what are you willing to do to have a school here? Are you willing to provide the land for the school? Are you willing to provide the labor to help build the school? You know, he would provide the teaching staff, and he would make sure it was well run, that kind of thing. But the people had to have skin in the game. And we really felt like that fit us. Same with some of the fields that are outside the mission. They actually allow people from that area to farm some of that land that they actually own. And part of the proceeds from what they farm go to help pay for some of the cost of their kids going to school.
Oh wow!
So it does foster a sense of responsibility. It's not just here's another handout.
Yeah.
And that really fit who we are.
Yeah, definitely. So 10 years of taking trips. What kind of work have you done in that 10 years? And maybe, you know, what are some highlights that stand out to you?
There's for me, I've been going, I started going in 2010. And I think there have only been 2 years that I haven't gone, since. And I would say the lion's share of the work that we've done, has been a combination of medical and construction. The two main focuses, we have a lot of medical professionals here at Good News Gathering.
Nurses, like our own hospital. It's weird.
Nurses, CNPs. We've had doctors who have gone with us before. And so typically the approach for the medical team is to go into more remote villages around La Croix, and to take, you know, to basically set up a mobile clinic and take, you know, what medications they can. They've done different things like deworming processes for children and things of that nature, as well as just meeting the needs for individuals who come, you know, complaining of various normal issues that they're struggling with. And so they do that, and then there's usually a construction project. Most of the time, it's a larger scale, because we tend to have relatively large construction teams, and we've got a lot of people around here or have in the past that have done a lot of construction work over the course of their lives, or people like me who, you know, don't know jack squat about any of that, but can swing a hammer and pick things up. So there's stuff to do, and by and large, we've typically done roofing projects for the lion's share of the years that we've been going. One year there was a There was a concrete project that the team did. That was the year I didn't go. And so by and large,
you only do roofing, no concrete. I'm
only roofing. No, unfortunately, that was the year we had. My wife was pregnant with our daughter, and we we decided because Zika was real big at that point, and so we passed on that year given the potential concern for that. So. But you know, usually it's some larger project like that. And those are really fulfilling. I think for our team, by and large, the construction teams, which is the ones I've been a part of, those have been very fulfilling projects because you go in and you've got a building with no roof or a building with a bad roof. And you, over the course of a week, you spend the time, you put in the effort, and the building has a new roof that, you know, students can sit under or people can go to church under or whatever. And there's a great deal of satisfaction walking away from a project like that because there's a felt need met in the course of 6 work days. And that's a really cool thing to watch and experience and be a part of, and to know that, okay, that building is now useful for real people in real situations right now, and that makes a very big impact not only on the people but also on the person doing it.
Yeah, definitely. And so I guess with that, what's been the most impactful? And I mean, the elephant in the room, you guys were there on the ground during the earthquake.
Yeah.
What year was that? That was
2010, January 12th.
So there was a massive earthquake. It was around Port-au-Prince, right?
Yep.
And just absolutely
devastated.
Yeah. The landscape, and you guys were on the ground.
We'd arrived 5 or 6 hours earlier.
Wow. So talk to me about that.
Well,
it's tough. It's a hard one.
That was a difficult year. Because we flew in that morning, which was odd because the first year we went, we flew in the evening. And that evening flight would have put us landing in Port-au-Prince right as that hurricane was, or earthquake was happening. And so for some reason, we decided to fly in the morning, and, we traveled north. We made it all the way to La Croix that day. And then as we're in the compound, we feel the earth shaking. Actually, JD and I were in a room upstairs in the building.
Working on a safe.
Yeah.
Pastor Pierre had bought an electronic safe, and he asked Dad and I to get it, like, plugged in and up and running and that whole 9 yards. And so we were working on it, and actually, like, Dad was reading the instructions and I was punching the keys and stuff like that. And all of a sudden the whole room starts shaking. And I looked at him and he looked at me, and it was kind of like, what was that? I mean, cause the thing about it is, in Haiti, a real stiff breeze can make the building kind of move a little bit. I mean, it's not, I mean, I'm exaggerating a hair,
the construction is different.
But I'm exaggerating a bit, but the construction is so different, and the buildings are so much lighter.
Which played into the devastation,
you know,
too.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, the buildings are so much lighter and less sturdy that you do feel a little bit more than you normally would in, say, an American building. And so, you know, we just kind of look at each other, and I think Dad was like, that was an earthquake. And he kind of moved to the doorway real quick, because, you know, in an earthquake, you know, doorways are, you know, more the safer spots to be in. And it stopped after about, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds maybe. Mm-hmm. And then that was just kind of it. It was like, oh, well, a little bit of an earthquake. There was no damage around us. And so it was just kind of like, oh, okay, that was weird, you know, and we kind of went on with the rest of our day. Mm-hmm. in all honesty. And the thing about it is the Wi-Fi and the electric and the internet down there, especially at that time, when they were kind of in their Wi-Fi infancy, down there, I mean, it was all so spotty anyway. You didn't know. Like, we had no idea that there was this massive earthquake that was killing people left and right 4 hours south of us. We had no idea. And so we're just kind of sitting there going, well, that was strange. I guess we survived an earthquake. That's cool. You know, like, honestly, we weren't even really all that broke up about it because we didn't know how bad it was.
Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where part of the reason I moved toward the door very quickly is because their construction down there, it's all cement. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking up and it's cement overhead, and you start thinking about that coming down on you, and that's not pleasant. So, but yeah, the communication was so spotty then in Haiti that and the electric was in and out every day. I mean, you knew the electric was going to be off for a certain number of hours every day. So it wasn't unusual. You didn't think anything of it. Not to have communication, not to have internet, not to have electricity. So we just went on about our day, not knowing that everybody up here in Ohio was watching the news, and they're seeing live coverage of all this devastation in Port-au-Prince, and we're clueless. And so people up here were scared to death, wondering what happened to us, wondering if we made it out of Port-au-Prince. And we didn't know. We didn't know a thing. We didn't realize. They've estimated now that 200,000 people died in Port-au-Prince. And they'll never know for sure because nobody actually knows how many people live there.
Wow.
And a lot of those people, unfortunately, were buried. And so they'll never know for sure. But when we finally figured out, which was, I think, fairly late in the evening.
Yeah, because mom did a nightly email to the church to let everybody know what was going on.
And was she with you or was she?
She was with us, yeah. Okay. And so at one point in the day, the power came back on and there was a little bit of internet, you know, that they could access. And so mom shot out this quick email. And in retrospect, it's kind of funny because mom was like, hey, we survived a little earthquake down here. No big deal. Everybody's safe. Just, you know, just wanted to let everybody know. And, you know, made this a part of this little email that she sent up to let everybody know that we were okay, which I think caused some relief on the side of the people down here. But it was obvious to them that we had no idea what was actually going on. But over the course of that day and then into the evening, there started to be reports, to Pastor Pierre that it was not good. And that there were actually some people that had died. And then as the night went along, that number just kept going like, no, it's big, it's big, it's really big now. They're thinking a whole load of people have died. And so it was almost immediate that discussions about whether or not we were going to leave started happening as that evening progressed. And there was no way we were going to get out the next day. So we planned a day where we were just going to work, you know, do what we came there to do, you know. So the next day we woke up and I'm fairly certain we painted classrooms for the bulk of the day. They had constructed a new building for kind of their high school area. And we painted all the classrooms that they had left to paint that day. And that was a really fun day because a lot of the kids were hanging around. And so we were, you know, we were painting and the kids were helping us paint.
And we just closed all the schools that day.
Closed all the schools. Yeah.
So the kids, a bunch of kids just showed up to hang out with the Americans really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was, that was one of the most difficult decisions that I think we've ever had to make because we knew the Port-au-Prince airport, they were projecting that the Port-au-Prince airport would not open for 3 weeks to a month. And so you're immediately thinking, okay, how do we go home? How do we get out of here? And obviously, going south to Port-au-Prince was out of the question. And so, in discussions with Pastor Pierre, he felt like it was best for us to be gone, to get out of town as quickly as we could. And part of that was because he was expecting a large number of basically refugees, people coming north to get away from Port-au-Prince, and he felt like all the food that we had brought down could be very helpful to the people who were traveling. And so rather than feed us for a whole week, he felt like we'd better to have the food we brought available for others. He also had some concerns because, you know, Haiti is a place where there's a lot of political unrest, and things can get very violent very quickly. And so he had significant concerns about the Americans and the possibility of kidnapping, that sort of thing. And so I think in some ways he just felt more comfortable if we were not there. And you have to understand, he has actually canceled a trip for us. 1 year we were all scheduled to go, and about 2 weeks before the trip, he called and said, "You're not coming." And that's a decision that he makes. And we respect that decision because he knows the country. And I can't remember what year it was, but 1 year he felt like there was an election coming up and things were getting very tense in the country, and he did not want to have to worry about us.
I think there was also a cholera issue at that point, too.
It's true.
There was a big cholera outbreak. There was a
cholera outbreak, which they ended up believing that some UN soldiers that were stationed there brought it with them. Wow. This is really sad.
So how did you get out? So Port-au-Prince Airport shut down for a month. How did you guys obviously made it home?
Yeah. So we had some people on the ground here who began doing a lot of legwork to try to get us out through the Dominican. So there were people here in Ohio, part of the church, that were calling. that were calling and doing a lot of work with airlines, and there was a resort in Puerto Plata, in the Dominican, and they actually got it sorted so that we could evacuate if Pastor Pierre could get us to the border. These people here at the church who had visited this place, they called them and they said, "Listen, there's a group of Americans. They're stuck in Haiti right now. They're going to try to get to the border. If so, we'll take care of the rooms. Just get them to the resort." And I'll be honest, like when that initial decision came down, you know, it was my first trip. So like, I had heard mom and dad talk about the trip from the year before. I was all excited about going. I go, boom, earthquake. And you got to understand, I'm 26, 27 years old, at the time. And I was mad, when the decision was made to leave. Not so much mad at anybody who made the decision. I was just mad about having to leave. Cause I'm thinking, this is the moment where they need us the most, and yet we have to leave. I understood Pastor Pierre's, you know, decision, and I thought it was wise and all that kind of stuff, but it just sucked to have to leave. And I was salty about it for a while because it was just one of those things where it just felt like we could do something. We're right here, and yet we couldn't. And to Pastor Pierre's credit, it was absolutely the right decision, and it was wise and all that stuff. But you just feel like trying to do something. So it was, I think it was I can't remember what day it was now, but we got up super early and we drive north and east to the Dominican border, and then we cross the border, and I'll never forget it. This is really funny. So we get to the Dominican border, and on the other side, you see all these vehicles lined up, and there's this big giant bus, like tour bus kind of thing. And it's like, oh, I guess because we had some communication with the people in Ohio that were working to try to get us there. You know, it's like, okay, so we're going to get on this bus and go, you know, cause you know, we're the only Americans standing around, you know? And so we're going to get on this bus and go. And so we finally get passed through the border. So we're stamped into the Dominican Republic, and we walk through, and all of a sudden that bus moves. And behind it is like a like an 8-passenger van. There's 20 of us. There's
20 of us.
All right. And so like all of a sudden this tour bus like takes off and it's gone. I mean, that's like, that's definitely not for us. And so we're standing there like, what are we riding in? And the guy, some guy comes over from this little 8-passenger van, like, okay, come with me. You know, and it's like, are you serious? And like, he proceeds, like he and another guy are in this van. And so he proceeds to cram all 20 of us into this 8-passenger van. All right. Load all of our stuff onto the top, the luggage on the top. I mean, people are sitting on each other's laps to accomplish this. So I'm sitting right on the edge of one of the seats and we start taking off down the road, and the dude, there was the driver, right? And then there was a dude with him. And the dude was sitting right across the seat from me, because like we're all kind of facing each other. It's like bench seats and stuff like that. And he leaves the sliding side door open for the entire trip, right? Well, it was about a 3-hour drive, and it's cool.
Which seemed longer
because you're sitting on each other, right? So it's about a 3-hour drive, which is in the side doors open. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, my dad is in this van. Multiple leadership team members were in this van. I, as the worship leader of the church, am in this van. And this dude's booking it like 70 miles per hour down the road.
Scary.
With the door hanging wide open. And I'm thinking, this dude could effectively eradicate the potential of having a service next Sunday, like if he screws up, you know, because at one point, like he hit a little water and kind of hydroplaned a little bit. And it was like, dude, like this, it was scary, but it stopped being scary and started being infuriating when the sun went down. Because it's all well and good when it's 85 degrees and that door's hanging wide open. It's a lot different when the sun goes down and it's now 70 degrees and you're flying along at 70 miles. I was cold. I was freezing. And I'm like literally shaking, you know, like I'm like getting.
And that's just so from the cold. Low level rage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Both, right.
It wasn't low level.
So, not anymore. So we pull, like we find like hours, like in this situation, right? We stopped once to go to the bathroom, but outside of that, we were flying the whole time. And we get into Puerto Plata. And we start to pull into this resort area, right? And he kind of wiggles back in his seat and shuts the door right before we pull onto the resort so that he didn't get caught driving around like that. And I was just like, I think I even said it out loud. I was like, are you serious? Like, are you serious? You know, like, oh, I was so angry. But we get in and they give us rooms and all this kind of stuff. And so I'm rooming with another guy on the trip, and we get into the room, and it's this 5-star resort kind of place, all inclusive deal, you know, which was culture shock from what we just left. I mean, it felt so wrong. I mean, like when we went to dinner that night, it was like a buffet the size of Texas. Like it was just food everywhere, as much as you wanted. It didn't matter. We weren't even paying for the rooms. Like, I mean, you went from mission trip to vacation in less than 24 hours. And it was like shocking and frustrating, and I was angry. Like I said, I was angry. And we're sitting in this room that night, and finally Tim and I turn on the TV, and it was the first time I'd seen what was actually happening. And I just remember, like, I don't cry about much, and I was sitting in the room like crying because I'm watching on the TV for the first time what I just left. And like, I mean, it was CNN, and they had live feed, like footage of people like half buried under rocks and building dead people, and, you know, little girls with, you know, with their arm crushed and rubble. And like, it was just, it was like, you couldn't put it into words what it was like to actually watch that after you knew you got out and you were safe and you just went to this crazy giant buffet that you didn't have to pay a dime for. And they had that to deal with. It was really, it was one of the worst experiences of my life.
It was tough. And it was hard because you're there to help. And your first instinct is, let's head south to Port-au-Prince. We can do something. We can do something. We can help in some way. And Pastor Pierre is like, no way. I'm not taking you south. And you know, those are times when we place ourselves under his leadership, and you have to do what the person on the ground tells you to do.
Yeah.
I will say that the one thing about the trip to to the Dominican that was disconcerting to me was the military checkpoints.
Yeah.
We must have passed through, I think, three military checkpoints going through the Dominican, and those were unnerving, because I was sitting in the passenger seat, and I had Kevin and Mary Black, I think, were both right there, because there were four of us sitting in the front, And I mean, these guys come up and you get stopped at these military checkpoints. These guys are kind of in uniform and kind of not. And so but they all got guns. I mean, they all got machine guns and stuff like that. And so that in and of itself is unnerving. But then they come up to my window and they're obviously asking me for my passport, which I do not want to give up. And they're yelling back and forth with the driver. And of course I can't understand them. Because they speak, I think, Spanish. And I'm just kind of, I probably had a deer in the headlights look on my face. But fortunately, none of them ever actually got my passport out of me, because they would always come up to me, since I was right there at the driver's side. And they would always want, you know, they're always wanting something. And you're thinking, okay, how soon are they going to start asking for money? That kind of thing. But our driver was able to finally get us through each one of those, but those were a little unnerving.
Yeah. And I find it interesting kind of the criterion that you set to choose a mission and how that really even played into protecting you guys when, you know, push came to shove.
Yeah.
That somebody was indigenous there, somebody respected, somebody was making his work, and then you can trust him to make those decisions. So we're kind of running out of time here, but as we wrap up, that was, you know, it was 8 years ago. I know, you know, it was a terrible experience, but we're still going. And from there, there's been a lot of ministry that has happened. And I don't want to paint a picture that this is every trip and just come and, you know, and you'll be terrified. Come and join us. That's, you know, that's not the goal. So what would you tell somebody who's thinking about going now of why they should invest their time, their money, maybe taking a week of vacation or whatever it is to do that? What makes that worth doing that now?
I think it's a tremendous growth experience, spiritual growth experience, because you're stepping out of your comfort zone. You're experiencing something that you would not experience in the United States. You know, I've had people ask me, well, why do you guys bother to go to Haiti? Why don't you just go to Adams County or some of the poor areas in the local area? Well, it's because poverty in Haiti is different than poverty in the United States. It is not the same. It's not even close. Here in the United States, we have certain safety nets. If you get in a really bad situation, there's help available for you. And doesn't have to come from your relatives, you know. but in Haiti, it's very different. There is no safety net there. It's I'll just give you an example that people in the United States would find impossible to believe. If you end up in the hospital in Haiti, they don't feed you. Your family has to bring you in meals, or you don't eat. And so, wow. It's that kind of thing that yeah. It's totally different than what we experience here.
Yeah.
And the level of poverty is so much more grinding there. When you think about the average Haitian lives on less than $2 a day, it begins to maybe put some things
into change perspective. Some perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's very important for us as Americans to experience that, because I don't think we have a clue how blessed we have been to have been born here and to live here in the United States. And so this experience will expand your horizons. And I think that's critical for us as Christians.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would echo all of that and say, you know, some of the, you know, I almost have come to love that week of the year because of the spiritual strengthening and renewal that come from it. Because, you know, I've found it really helpful to me because it's a mind clearing experience in a lot of ways, because you're out from the norm. When you're out in the way from the compound, the cell phone doesn't work, right? You're not getting text messages. You're not getting phone calls. You're not worrying about what's happening back here. Now, certainly like last year, I was concerned to call my wife every night when I got back and see how she and the kids were doing and stuff like that. But during the day, you are very much just in the moment. It's a clearing experience, I think. And God's able to really do some work with you and in you and through you during that process. And so I think for me, I've almost come to rely upon it as an annual departure from the norm that recharges me for whatever it is that God's calling me to do when I come back. And I think to some degree or another, it's not, obviously most trips aren't nearly as dramatic as the 2010 trip. But there's always something that challenges you physically, emotionally, and spiritually that gives you the chance to grow from it. And you see things that you just don't see anywhere else. You hear things and experience things. And in many ways, all of us get pushed to learn a lot through that process. So I think it's one of the most valuable experiences in my yearly calendar.
Yeah, there's spiritual growth, there's the cleansing.
Yep.
You mm-hmm. probably even add community. There's a community
big
sense
time.
Of working with those people that are coming, you know, from here with you, and you're traveling and
yeah,
getting to know them. And you can see that actually on you guys when you come back from a trip, the bonds that have been built through struggle and sweat and suffering
and inside jokes and stuff yeah. like that. I mean, yeah. It's, you know, it's one of those things where this past year was one of the most connected construction crews I've ever been a part of. And it wasn't because maybe it was the most talented construction crew. Like we've had other construction crews that equally talented, led well, all that kind of stuff. But this group, just everybody kind of found their fit. And we worked together like a machine. We got done way more than we expected to get done, and I think than was expected of us. And that was a really powerful experience, I think, when you get those. And so the development of those relationships is really cool.
Yeah. And those nights up on the rooftop are just
absolutely.
There's something really special about that experience. You're out there. You're under the stars. Sometimes in distance, depending on the night, you can hear voodoo drums in the distance, and we have devotion time and sharing time. How was your day? And what was your highlight? That sort of thing, and those are just cool moments.
Yeah,
it's a great experience.
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, we are recording this on Wednesday, the 23rd of May, and tonight is a rice and beans meal packing, and through Lifeline Ministries, we're packing. How many meals are we hoping to pack tonight?
29,000.
Yeah, 29,000, and in a couple of hours, that will be accomplished, and yeah. It's quite the process. So if you've never been a part of that, we encourage you to, if you're listening this afternoon, call up to the Ministry Center office and let us know you're coming, because that will help us, you know, because we're assigning people to tables, things like that. The other thing we want to encourage you, if this talk has spurred you to say, man, I think I'd be interested in Haiti. There are a couple different informational meetings happening. One is happening this coming Sunday, following both services. There's going to be a meeting after each service. So you can just come, no commitment, just come and get some information about what's going on, what would be required. And then there's also another one on June 10th. So this Sunday and June 10th. And then those trips usually happen the first of the year, in January.
First part of January.
Yeah, first part of January. So, and so we'd love for you to,
those meetings will be in the conference room in the new edition
conference room. Yeah.
So there will be plenty of space to get as many people in there as we can.
So that's great. Well, guys, this has been great hearing that. Thank you for sharing, some difficult things on that. But I'm sure, God has used that in your life. And so we just pray that for more continued years, with La Croix Mission and supporting them and them growing us. And so it's been great. So until, next week, we hope to, see you this weekend. So
take care, everybody. See you.